All right, folks, shalom and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are, and of course, you are part of the Land of Israel Network, found at thelandofisrael.com. Great honor and pleasure to be broadcasting to you today from the heart of Jerusalem, which is Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov in Nachlaot, Jerusalem. Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me on Spiritual Cafe. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
It's great to see you, Shai.
It's great to be with you, and it's a hot, hot day out there. Yesterday was a tad cooler, and that was good because one of my beloved rabbis, actually somebody I called, you know, we have two words that we can conjugate in so many ways. One of them is Rav or Rabbi. We can say Rabbanan,
Rabbeinu,
Rebbe,
Rabotenu,
Rav, Rabbi, Rebbe. We have so many Rebbe. There's so many ways of saying that term. We're like, it's like the word snow in Inuit. In Inuit, that's right, in the First Nations. The other word is Kodesh, the three letters Kodesh. There is 100 different ways you could say. Yesterday I saw a good one.
Yeah, most people don't know what it means.
Right. Well, what does it mean exactly? How do you translate it?
Devoted to.
Devoted, betrothed, special.
Yes.
Okay, but we have everything from Kaddish to Kedusha to Kiddush.
Hektish.
Mikdash. It does not stop. That word, those two words, you could just conjugate them in 1,000 different ways. Yesterday I saw a food truck. No, excuse me, not a food truck. That's what I thought at first. It was a Judaica store called Kucha. Like Kucha
Brichu.
Right. I was like, there goes
awesome.
Another one. And that's yesterday, somebody who I use one of those terms, somebody I don't call anybody this, but this one man, I call him Rebbe, my Rebbe. That means that he's my rabbi, but he's a rabbi that I have a certain special affection to. But also that is a more Americanized term. He's my Rebbe. Here in Israel, I might call him my Rav, but he happens to be my Rebbe, and that's my teacher, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, from Munson, New York, and from Yeshiva University. And he was here. He is here in town. He is turning 90 soon.
Wow.
He is
healthy and well.
Yeah. He is for his age, he is sprightly, very well-humored, and, of course, sharp as a tack. And when he comes in, it becomes a minhag. It has become a minhag. A custom of ours to go up on the Temple Mount with him. Amazingly, on his last visit, we went up to the Temple Mount, and we were practically under attack from a jihadist mob who gave us the Allahu Akbaritis treatment to such an extent that they had surrounded us with a mob. And there was a moment that I was like looking around for rocks, thinking to myself, okay, it's going to go down. Let's
gotta arm ourselves.
Myself. Right. It was so intense. Since then, Gilad Erdan, the new Minister of Internal Security, has stepped up. He's calmed it down. The Temple Mount is much calmer again. So we went up yesterday almost without a hitch. They opened up the Western Wall Plaza for Rabbi Tendler so he can park close. You know, he walks leaning on two students. We were surrounded by the Waqif and surrounded by an outer ring of Israeli police. And what my problem is that... the Waqif is there watching every movement of our mouth to make sure that we do not pray. And this humiliation in what I call the capital of our capitals, the capital of our capital, which is the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. It's one thing to be humiliated by a jihadist, very regressive, very 13th century,
best.
Right, attitude. What is absolutely incomprehensible is that this policy is being actually enforced by our very own police, who are making sure that the Waqif can make sure that we don't pray and don't move our lips or bow down or do anything deemed inappropriate, taking away the most basic human rights. And yesterday I recorded a video speaking with a lot of respect, but directly to the Prime Minister of Israel and saying to him, listen, we're asking for basic human rights here. Nobody's talking about a third temple. Nobody's talking about World War III. Notice both those are threes, right? We're not talking about
third
those.
Third time's charm.
Right? I'm asking for basic human rights. Give me a space here on this humongous plaza to pray. Give me a time or something, but treat me decently in Zionism, which was supposed to, in a time of Zionism, which is supposed to be a time of the assertion of Jewish rights and basic dignities by our own government and our own strength. Yet the exact opposite is happening.
What's always struck me about the power of the tension that's there is there's a positive side to it, which I think in many ways the forces that be refuse to see. But we as Jews who believe in the power of prayer should really hone in on it, which is, why is the Muslim religious authority so afraid of you praying there? Right? Because they understand the power of prayer in general, the power of the prayer of the Jew in particular, and the power of the prayer of the Jew in that place above all. And so the angst and anger and tension, which you said, you know, last year almost ended in a riot, and we know has actually ended so, right, should be an indicator to us that we have our finger on a potential which is unfathomable.
Many Jews, though, don't want to put their finger on that.
Well, that's precisely my point, and I believe that that's what's causing that horrible situation you're talking about, with Israeli police enforcing something, which, by the way, the courts haven't actually deemed to be legal. The police are still,
meaning to say,
power of Jewish prayer, that Jews are, is legal for a Jew to pray there.
Right. The Supreme Court has upheld the rights of Jews to
pray.
And
the police say because of the fear of public disorder, they basically are trumping the law, which is a power that the police exercise in general. But notice the logic, that it's all fueled by the fact that the Muslims are willing to kill and die to prevent you from saying Ashrei on top of the Temple Mount.
Right.
It's an astounding thing. And in the same way, Lahavdil, that Hitler had the greatest clarity on the power of the Jewish people that the 20th century knew, except for perhaps, you know, some of the early Zionists. Why? Because he wanted to rule the world. And he was pretty darn close. But he understood, oddly enough, that in order to rule the world, it wasn't that he had to defeat Great Britain or the industrial might of America or that he had to span the Pacific. Okay, that's true. I mean, that's technical. But you really want to rule the world? You got to get rid of the Jews.
There you go. So it's big, and it's so funny how few Jews are actually participating in this fight for basic human rights. I am happy to see, by the way, that there are some secular Jews, or at least non-kippah-wearing Jews, that have also come to realization that this is that spot, which is on the one hand, as you say, about prayer and about our relationship with God and this amazing spark plug in the world. But it's also about basic human dignities, and there's Jews that are fighting for that today. And we come right now to the Torah portion of Matot, which is towards the end. Usually it's read together with Matot and Maaseh. We usually finish off the book of Numbers, the book of In the Desert, the book of Jewish leadership or politics with this Torah portion. But happily for the folks in the United States of America and outside of Israel, they're going to be catching up with us. They're going to be reading two Torah portions. Wait, they're going to be... They're reading two this Shabbos.
No, they'll read two next week.
They'll read two next week. That's right. They are reading
Pinchas. They're reading Pinchas this week, and they'll read Matot Maaseh next week.
They'll read Matot Maaseh, and we're going to be reading Matot. And this Torah portion, which is about chapter 30 in the book of Numbers, starts off in a very strange fashion. It starts off actually with the laws of vows and oaths. Vows and oaths. And there's a distinction between those two things. I'll read to you a little bit from a book that, by the way, if you are looking to get into Judaism, want a little bit more depth in what the Torah is about, I highly recommend buying yourself an art scroll, Chumash. It's called the Stone Edition Chumash. It's a little blue, different, and absolutely worth it to get it. The amount of writing that they've put into it, it's really fantastic. And I, by the way, don't appreciate art scroll dissers, okay? I know there's a whole camp of... There's a camp. I'm not appreciative of it. I think the art scroll is a fantastic book. It may sometimes not be totally this or totally that. It's a
huge contribution.
That's exactly what it is. And if you would only dedicate yourself to read the notes that they've written on every Torah portion, you will have learned a lot of Judaism. Okay, anyway, they start by saying, the Torah introduces a chapter which, upon reflection, gives a person to do something that herefore could only be done by God, to create a new halachic Jewish legal status. By pronouncing the sort of vow or oath set forth in the passage, a person is given the power to invoke a neder, a vow or an oath, thereby placing upon himself or others, or upon objects of his choice, a status equivalent to that of a commandment of the Torah. His neder is so strong that a person violating it can suffer the court-imposed penalty of lashes. So basically, and one more paragraph, there are two categories of neder. One could prohibit himself something that the Torah permits by saying, for example, the produce of such or such country is forbidden to me for 30 days, or one may obligate himself to bring an optional offering or to perform an optional commandment, such as to contribute to a particular charity or to consecrate a particular animal as an offering. So basically, a neder is it's an oath, the way you understand it in mm-hmm. English. You're taking upon yourself something that you didn't have to take upon yourself before.
And the power in what I heard you read is that you create through that a new reality, right? And that's the I think, why it's placed here at the beginning of this parasha, is that, as the author there said, is that something which heretofore had been the realm of God, right, that to create new spirituality is now being given into the hands of Am Yisrael. And in the same way, where are we physically in our narrative right now? Like in our travels, we've come to the edge of the Jordan, right? We're at the gate of the land of Israel. And that's exactly what land of Israel is going to offer, is the power through our actions to create new realities. Right, up until now, they've been out in the desert, eating the manna, drinking from the well, wrapped in the clouds of glory, in this divine state, but it's a divine and somewhat disembodied state. And taking a vow is a commitment to embody some inner sense you have in the world in a real way. And that being the lead-in to going into the land of Israel is the exact same thing. Stepping into life on that scale and the commitment it makes to the messiness and the complexity that will lie beyond that sort of ideal divine state, and yet the potential for new reality.
Yet the rabbis will tell us that try to stay away from taking oaths and nedarim. Don't go there. The same thing they say about becoming a Nazarite, a Nazarene, a Nazir in any case.
And we see the people's hesitation upon entry into the land. I mean, you know, one of the great questions that I was raised for me, rather, by one of the writings of the Chatam Sofer, 19th century sage. He says, listen, here you have a people at the edge of a good green land. They were slaves for 210 years, but then wandering in the wilderness for 40 more. In that period in the world, what do you do at that moment? You go in, you kill everyone there, and you take the land. That's called history. Why did God have to command us? Right, what was the hesitation? So it's twofold. One is what the Chatam Sofer says, the nature of the Jewish people is rachmanim, baishanim, gomle chasadim, merciful, sort of bashful, and wanting to do good. And God said, that's great, but if you want to do that in the world, you got to have a place to do it, and that's it. The other one is that desire to just be with God and not be in the world, which the Torah fights against tooth and nail, which is why the sages say, don't bind yourself with oaths and retreat from your desires and, you know, stay away from the gritty nature of reality. If you need to do it, so it's there for you, right? And so the messiness of coming into the land of Israel, I think, has always frightened people.
By the way, the animals in the ark also needed to be taken out. There's an interesting yep. word there that God kind of says, like, activate them or push them out. Usually you open a door for an animal and the animal will rush out.
Yeah, sure.
But they were either in a catatonic, a frozen, or an ideal, kind of a state of idea, a state of data inside the ark, and Noah had to activate them in order to set them free. I've got a wild theory about the ark. Okay, it's just
the one down in Tennessee?
I haven't seen that one. My theory about the Ark is that somehow, if you want to visualize it, Noah was really a great geneticist, and he was able to reduce all the animals into, what do you call them?
Their DNA.
Right, their DNA, and that's how he was able to fit them
chromosomes.
All
chromosomes.
And you can find ways to undermine what I just said, but the Chassidut actually says something similar. He said that they existed inside the Ark in a state of an idea.
Yes.
I call it like a state of data, in a state of a seed, just like yes. a seed contains within it. And that's what the ark was. It was a giant floating seed that had the seed for the world. The world was wiped out. It was the hard drive was
wiped.
Was wiped.
Yes. Yes, for
it
sure.
It was rooted, you know, and you had to restart the whole thing. And here, too, the Jewish people in the 40 years of wandering, they existed in this kind of potential energy, this data form.
Conceptual state.
Right. And in order to activate them, you almost have to kind of give birth to them as, you know, the 3D printer has got to get turned on. Like the idea, the file is there, but you got to print it and make them alive and push them into the land.
And in this case, the DNA, so to speak, the source code, you know, in modern high-tech language, is the Torah. Right. And we see this throughout history. You know, I'm teaching history now for, you know, 8 years. And one of the things that's always struck me is that you plant the Torah, and it will grow. Right? You plant it in Babylon after it gets uprooted from the land of Israel, and it flowers into the Gemaras and the Academies. You plant it in Spain when the Academies begin to fade. It flowers into incredible poetry and philosophy and depth of Talmud knowledge. You plant it in Poland. You plant it in America. You plant it back here in Israel. And here's the thing, is that this is its native soil. So you can take a seed, and you might be able to get it grow one place or another. It might even bear fruit, but you'll never really know what it is until you put it in its native soil.
And that, I think, is also the tension between the diaspora and Israel today. I remember when I was young, I remember a distinct feeling that the diaspora was the uber dog. And
we
Israel
were the poor
was
cousin here.
Right. Israel was the underdog. And I have seen in my lifetime, now 40 years, ladies and gentlemen, 40 years, thank you. 40 years, I see clearly that the, how do we call it in English? Mishva'a, the equation. The equation
has shifted.
Has shifted. It's the opposite now. And yet still, we're trying to kind of activate Jews in the diaspora and reality striking them in the face. And there's always an option not to go to the land of Israel, but there's such a call to come in and become activated in a full sense.
It's a tremendous call. And I mean, in my work at the Pardes Institute, I teach students who live in America. And what I've seen as part of that is a dissipation of the notion of diaspora. Right? These are Jews who have rejected the notion that they're in exile, see themselves at home, are in the process of constructing a Jewish identity which will be able to engage that new vision, which in many ways has a lot of potential. In others, I think is the end of a certain process, which is frightening to me.
Just if you could unpack that, what you mean to say in bigger words and in more words is that some Jews are trying to come that live in America are trying to come to some kind of new Jewish vision where America is home, where they're either supportive or not supportive of the state of Israel. But you know,
but
as we said about Poland, Polano.
Yeah, no, but
we are home here.
But it's deeper than that. I mean, this is not that's not a new phenomenon, right? And once upon a time, Berlin was the new Jerusalem, and to say that New York is or LA is or whatever it's consistent. What I'm saying is that there's been such a welcoming embrace and a melting into the culture, right? The rates of assimilation, we call the Pew Report that came out a couple of years ago, the numbers now tell it all. So that only tells half the story. What I'm seeing is an incredible ferment of new ways of articulating what it means to people to be Jewish. Forget whether these are traditional and forget judgments on whether they're legitimate. Just saying how people are living their lives, deeply wanting to be Jews, and yet not accepting the traditional notions, which are really bound up with the centrality of the land of Israel, and therefore innovating what are sometimes exciting and sometimes disastrous new ways of being.
It's funny that you mentioned that topic, because maybe this Torah portion, above all others, struggles with the issue of diaspora versus the land of Israel. One can make that argument. We don't have to agree with that. But we have two tribes that are going to be saying, look, it's fantastically interesting language. They say, look, our inheritance has come to us, or we have come to our inheritance, meaning to say the Transjordan area, that's the Israel that we want. We are happy here. And we also have halachic grounding. It was conquered by the Jewish people. You, Moses, the holiest of all people, conquered Sihon and Og. We want to stay here. It is economically fruitious for us, okay?
Fruitful.
It is good for our economy. We want to build gates for and pens for our animals. We want to build cities for our children, and that's the order that they originally set it in before Moses smacked them for talking that way, first about economics and then about their children. And Moses, when they make this offer, saying, you know what, we don't want to go into the land of Israel. We just want to stay right here. This is great. Moses is like perturbed,
devastated.
Okay. He's devastated. He's also like consternated, and he gives them the talk. He's like, let me tell you about why we're here in the desert now. Do you know why? Because your forefathers had a bad culture, and that's the word tarbut. Tarbut ra. It's a unique word in the Torah, meaning to say like their culture or the ways of behavior, and they rejected the land of Israel. They were full of fear. They melted the hearts of their brother. A whole generation died. And now here you have come saying that you want the same thing, you know, you hear the smack sound, you know, could that be so? And they come back with an argument saying, oh, and he also says, and now will you melt, and here's the point, will you melt the hearts of your brothers yet again by not coming into the land of Israel and not fighting for conquering the land of Israel, facing the enemies and all that? How could you do the same thing and melt the hearts of your brothers by basically turning your back on the land of Israel? And they basically make an argument saying, first of all, we are going into the land. And we're going to send our menfolk to be fighters in the land. And we're going to help you conquer the land. Only then will we return back to this land. And Moses is going to make them kind of take an oath, saying, you know, in front of witnesses, saying, you know, if they do this, then fine. And if they don't do it, then not fine. It's a kind of called the double oath. But basically, when I was last at AIPAC, at the AIPAC gathering in Washington, D.C., some good folks who speak about the diaspora-Israel relations gave models for alternative ways that we could see how Jews interact with one another between the diaspora and between Israel. They gave this as one of the examples of a working relationship that part of the Jewish people, in this case, two tribes, and then another half tribe is added in. The tribe of Menashe is added in to be like a bridge. These two and a half tribes were on the Transjordan, on the other side of the land of Israel. They weren't in the land of Israel, and yet they still stayed connected and together with the history of the Jewish people. So what is this whole, you know, kind of, what is the motivation of Reuven, Gad, and the half of the Menashe tribes? They're disappointing Moses so badly, and they're the, one way to look at it is they're the first diaspora.
They are also literally the first diaspora. When the Assyrians come in the 8th century before the Common Era and destroy the northern kingdom of Israel, they take away the tribes of Reuven and Gad first. At the same time, I think that there is a tremendously positive potential. They've expanded the scope of the land of Israel, right? I mean, as you said, it was conquered by the full people, and indeed it is seen as part of the tribal lands. But what always speaks to me about it is it's so personal. They say, listen, this land is good for cattle. We have cattle, as if it was a surprise. Look, we have cattle. But they felt a deep personal connection there. I can't speak to the AIPAC model. I mean, I'm a little bit wary of comparing people who live in the United States to people who live. I mean, he's not talking about all of American Jewry conquering Amman. So meaning it's in a metaphorical sense, I understand it. But there's very, very powerful element to sharing a border, right? And that's actually how the book of Joshua, to a certain degree, ends, right? After the tribe of Reuven and Gad get their reward in having participated in the conquest, and they go back and they build an altar to the Lord right on the border, and like all the camp of Israel goes nuts because there's only one altar to the Lord. It's in the center of the camp, and they go out to war to destroy, like they suddenly become idolatrous. And what is the response? Do you remember that Reuven and Gad gave? They said, listen, no, we don't plan on worshiping on this altar. We just want this as proof that we're actually part of the Jewish people. Because we don't want your children to come to our children later and say, what? You live over there on the other side of the Jordan? You're not part of us. So they built the Israelite altar, right? The four-horned altar that we know was the characteristic of Am Yisrael. So I think that concern speaks a lot to what we're dealing with. It was their personal connection. They felt this was their place. And yet, what underlay was a fear that in choosing that they would be cut off from the wholeness of the people. And I think that's a lot of the tension that's happening between us and the diaspora now. People want to be who they are. And I can relate to that. They don't feel at home here. They don't feel it's their culture. I can understand that's a challenge. I mean, you immigrated just like I did. There's a real challenge there, right? At the same time, it's a question of whether you see yourself primarily as part of Am Yisrael and then in your own personal expression of who you are, or primarily as who you are, and then you'll be or you won't be part of Am Yisrael.
So the lecturer that was talking about this gave other examples as well. He gave three examples. This was the second. His first example was Lot, and how Lot comes out to Abraham, and he says, look, we got too much cattle to share the space. Let me separate out from you. And Abraham says, okay, you know, you go this way, I go this way. I understand. I may not be very happy about it, like Moses wasn't happy about it in this case. But okay, you know, and go, you know, go on and be successful. And this lecturer, and I don't want to use his name in order not to embarrass him, used these models as explaining how Jews can get along with one another. So I was the first question, and the Lord caused him to pick on me. And this is one of fun for a lunch.
You mean to pick you, not to pick on you.
No, to pick me as the first person to ask a question. I said to him, listen, these models that you gave us, I don't remember what the third one was, but the third one was just as egregious. I said, all of them ended in utter abysmal failure.
Yeah.
You give these models. I said to him, the children of Lot don't only go away from the Jewish people, they become the enemies of the Jews.
Not to mention how they come into the world.
Right, right. And they're the quintessential opposite of Jews. They're the enemies of the Jews. And the two and a half tribes, as you said, they're the first to be exiled. They're the ones with the weakest connection. They're out. He may have, I don't remember, maybe he gave the example of the Jews of Alexandria. I'm not sure. There was some example. Every one of these examples was a complete abysmal failure, even though it had its moment. It had its shining moment. Maybe there was peace between Abraham and Lot. Maybe there was peace between, as you just described, you know, the two and a half tribes and the Jewish and the rest of the Jewish people. Maybe between the Jews of Alexandria and the Jews of Israel. But it all ended so poorly. So he says to me, and everybody clapped because we're at AIPAC here. We're not here to
justify.
Sometimes I wonder, is AIPAC really dedicated to justifying the existence of the Jewish people in the diaspora by giving them a justification, an excuse of how they're really helping the process of Israel, but really get a chance to stay over there? In any case, he says to me, well, I don't know which one of these two communities is Abraham and which one is Lot. Meaning to say, he was such a, you know, he was trying to say that, you know, maybe it's the Israeli community, which is the one that's going to go far afield. And that's maybe part of the kind of discourse that you hear a lot about from America today, from American Jewry, that Israel is going wayward instead of, you know.
Is the big stick in the media right now.
We've
gone off the rails.
Right, we're off the rails.
Right, but the problem is that itself is proof of our discussion, because what they're using to judge whether we're going the right way or not are, you know, Western liberal democratic standards, which are not intrinsically bad, but in many of the cases that they're applying them are actually not relevant to the reality in which we're living.
He also said you would like this very much. He made a distinction, and I wanted to make that distinction for you also. He said there's a distinction between exile and diaspora. He says very honestly, he said, we in America, we're not in exile.
Yes, they're not.
We're not in exile. We're in diaspora. We might be a diaspora of the Jewish community or whatever. That's the word that he chose. But
right.
He said, if we want to get on a plane, we can just get on a plane.
Right, and the definition of exile is an inner state of believing you're not where you belong. And there's only so long you can live in that type of tension in today's world where you could, if you really believe you're not where you belong, you could get up and do something about it.
Right.
In 13th century Rhineland, they knew they were not where they belonged, and there wasn't much they could do about it.
Right.
This is a really, really big tension.
Okay, and speaking of this tension, we're talking about exile. We're going to be reading about exile in the Haftorah, in the readings from the prophets that we read and the writings that we read every Shabbat. We read a small portion of it. And because of the period that we're in that we haven't really discussed, really the period of the exile, the break of the Jewish people, the destruction of Jerusalem, the exile of the Jewish people from the land of Israel. These are called the 3 weeks. And they started this past Shabbat, actually, on the 17th of Tammuz, the day in which Moses breaks the two tablets. And then later on, when the walls of Jerusalem begin to break under besiegement.
It's the fast of brokenness.
It's the fast of brokenness. And 3 weeks that lead up to the 9th of Av. In Jewish tradition, these 3 weeks are weeks that you want to stay away from, for example, buying and putting on a new shirt. You're not supposed to say the Shehecheyanu blessings for anything new. These are weeks which don't be surprised if your air conditioner or your fridge or your car break somehow, because little cracks, little echoes of the destruction of the temple continue to echo in this world. I remember all too well when one of my Casio cameras broke on a Nadia Matar march to open up the tomb of Rachel to car traffic. It was exactly on the 9th of Av. and that was a $400 camera. It was expensive at the time. Now, I remember that camera fondly. Maybe I should get off this topic, but the bottom line is that I remember how that broke then, and that's the 3 weeks that we're in right now, and we read three special lamentations of sorts, sad readings, all three of which, by the way, also end with some positivity and a memory that a memory of good times and a promise that good times will return again.
And it's that dynamic between memory and promise which really characterizes the power of this time. Right? Meaning the roots of this time are in the memories of brokenness. You listed them so well, right? That breaking of the tablets, which really was the loss of the purity of the moment of Sinai, and the breaking of the walls of Jerusalem, which just opened up the beginning of the end. And also one of the things that always speaks to me is that we mark this as the end of the korbanot, the end of the offerings, right? That the altar ceased to exist as that connection between heaven and earth. Right? And yet, if we were just going to dwell on the brokenness, we would have given up as a people long ago. I mean, that's a short list of everything that even in just these 3 weeks throughout our history have happened. And so there has to be a way in which our touching that state of brokenness is able to open out for us some horizon of vision, right? Some promise. And not just like on a psychological level of like, I can't handle it anymore. You got to tell me it's going to get better at some time. But to look into our brokenness and understand how it is that we ended up where we are. And so Rambam says all these times of fast are times of tshuva, the times of repentance. When I look at my life, at our national life, and I say, how did we get to where we are now? What can I do different in order to get us where I want to go? And that's why I believe all of these prophecies end with that positive note, because the prophet is assuming that you're actually listening. You're not just lamenting and beating your breast. You're saying, oh gosh, how did we get where we are? How is it that I'm in exile, and how do I get out?
Yesterday, I got a chance to participate in something very special. Chabad has something called Chabad Lubavitch organization has something called Kolel Chabad, and they do amazing work with orphans here in Israel. I got a chance to be at a scholarship award ceremony. The Barad family donated money for the scholarship, and basically this is a scholarship for orphans, and these orphans, it's not just a scholarship, here you go, you're orphan. Throughout the year, they have to send in their test scores. With every test score, they get points, and these points turn out to be a bigger scholarship.
Wow.
And it motivates them throughout the year. There was 83 of them, or 85 of them, yesterday, and I got to interview also some of their families, the moms, and I interviewed Mrs. Mizrahi, who the wife of Baruch Mizrahi, Hashem Yikom Damo, who was murdered 2 years ago. He was a 25-year soldier and police officer. He was the head of the cyber unit in Israel. Really did a lot of secret work to protect the state of Israel. They were driving in the car. Four of the five kids with them. A lone shooter was standing out there. He started shooting at the car. Many bullets flew in. Some unbelievable number of bullets flew into the car. It killed Baruch immediately. And his wife was injured. The kids were all right. And she was talking yesterday about the strength of the minute that he was dead, she saw that he was gone, he was hit in the head type of thing, and she knew. She said I'm gonna live. She made this conscious decision. I'm gonna live for my kids, and that really it reminds me of, on the one hand, the exile, the state of affairs in which it's not all perfect, and yet that yearning to continue to move forward. On the other side of that coin, today, near Barkat, the mayor of Jerusalem is coming to Hebron.
Oh.
And that's where I get to work. And the mayor of Jerusalem is coming to Hebron. I think that's very symbolic. Certainly, he has his own ambitions within the Likud, and he may be one day prime minister, who knows. But he's coming to Hebron today to connect with the roots, maybe to get a photo op as well. No problem with that at all. There is an outreach from Jerusalem to these communities that have not yet been fully built up. I think that also speaks about redemption and elements of exile and trying to bring them in. We're trying to unite the Jewish people and hold them together.
And I think that the most important way to do it is to look people in the face. I feel like a lot of the time the ultimate expression of exile that we have is the fact that we have a hard time looking people in the face if we don't believe that they share our worldview or that they feel the same way we do, right? There is a tremendous shying away and a projecting. Like the media serves this so well. It's like the settlers or the leftists or the Arabs or whomever, right? And I think there's a really powerful thing that we can all do. I mean, there's obviously much more at play, but something that everyone can do is really try to just see who it is we're interacting with.
I think what you're saying is so important right now, and I think given especially the very recent trend of the last 4 or 5 years, maybe the last 8 years of the Obama administration, to be super polarized.
Yes.
There is a super polarization that's happening right now, and I can feel it about myself. If things are so polarized, I can't read a lot of newspapers because they're so polarized against things that I believe in. It's hard for me to even just swallow their content. I can't even go there. And I know it's my responsibility to try to go there, to do what you just said, to go there and to kind of see the other side. But I feel like it's become very, very polarized.
But it's not even seeing the other side. And I think I can relate to the problem with the media, because the media, I feel like, is it's hard to know whether they're the culprit or they're just the expression of this. But they're certainly
culprit.
Deep in the mix. But I'm not speaking about seeing the other side. I'm speaking about seeing the other person beyond the side.
Right.
And
beyond the ideas and politics.
Yeah. Just another human being, particularly right. Here in Eretz Israel, the other Jew.
It's tricky.
So important.
It's become really tricky.
It's become really tricky.
And it's become especially tricky with younger people.
Why so?
I don't know. Just my experience is that dealing with especially young American Jews, a talk I gave last week, I really feel that they are looking at me as an issue. I stand for something. I represent something.
Apparently, you're a termite.
I'm. What do you mean by that?
You didn't see in the media there was a
I missed that one.
Representative of the Democratic Party who called settlers burrowing termites.
Oh, no. not termites. More like beavers. building up our dams.
Busy building.
Yeah, busy building. And then after being busy building, becoming a Borsellino hat, and that's also Jewish. My bottom line is that there is a tension right now where I don't know, somehow I'm sensing more and more that there's this super polarization, and I think that you're absolutely right. See me as a person, let me see you as a person. And part of that, part of the solution for seeing as a person is also a little bit of laughter,
yeah.
A little bit of humor. Maybe it's not a lot in the Bible, but that's part of the Jewish DNA. Laugh at it a little bit.
I spoke
to this classroom. I made jokes, and I usually am good with jokes and stuff. They were just
straight face.
They were just like, "No,
tough
you're not
crowd.
Getting away with that. You're not.
Tough
we're
crowd.
Not laughing.
Don't
here,
be
buddy.
Charming,
settler boy."
Yeah.
Okay. Like, oh God.
Well, I want to say something very hopeful though, in the night, because I was surprised when you said about the youth, because I don't know if you know what's been happening here in Jerusalem on Thursday nights.
No.
In Zion Square, since the murder of Shira Bankey, who was killed in last year's Pride Parade. Right, there have been groups of young people sitting together in circles that deliberately from various types of life, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, Haredi, national, religious, gay, straight, every time sitting around and having these conversation circles. Mm-hmm. And it's become facilitated, it's become a phenomenon, and we're talking about like dozens if not hundreds of kids willing to look each other in the face.
I always look for an excuse to go to town. To the heart of Jerusalem.
So you gotta go Thursday night.
Thursday night. That used to be like Thursday night. Like if I wasn't in town Thursday night, I wasn't alive.
But this is now an outgrowth.
That's
outgrowth
awesome.
Of that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm definitely gonna be there. And of course, Zion Square. If you just put a lawn chair down and sit in Zion Square, you will see everybody who's been in your life. You just have to sit there long enough.
So
you will
true.
See the whole gamut. And I love Zion Square very much. I think there was even a band or something called Zion Square for a while. I love that. Love that place, Kikar Tzion. So. Come to Kikar Tzion in Jerusalem. You'll see everything. Come to Hebron, where the mothers and fathers of the Jewish people are waiting to see you. Embrace Grandma and Grandpa. Thank you so much for the opportunity to work in Hebron. Thank you so much to thelandofisrael.com for this fantastic and fabulous network with many other great show hosts. Check out Eve Harrow, Josh Haston, Shlomo Katz, Ari and Jeremy, and of course, the Yishai Fleischer Show, of course, with Rabbi Mike Foyer. The Spiritual Cafe every single week. We have more great stuff for you on the way today. Oh, before we go, Rabbi Mike, before we go, I want to say a few more shout-outs very quickly. One shout-out to one of the two most devoted listeners.
Whoa.
Yes. One is Yechiel out in Beit El. He has been with this show for years and years and years. And I just want to say, Yechiel, keep it up, buddy. God bless you. Mazal tov on the new kids. Mazal tov on everything, on your good work. And thank you so much for being part of the show and part of our life. God bless you out there, and hope to see you again soon. And Grandpa Walter. Grandpa Walter out in Florida is again a stalwart, a follower of the show and of our lives as well. But Grandpa, thank you so much for being out there. God bless you. Be strong. Amazing. Also, I want to say hi to Lucinda. Lucinda is a listener from Tennessee. She says, love your show. Never miss one. I may be a few days tardy in sending this. We have been traveling this summer, so I listened to it from Oregon coast with not much internet. So I didn't get to respond right away. That's good for you, Lucinda, that you're out in a place where there's not a lot of internet. That's fun. I hope to be in Israel someday. We listen and support you all. Your conversation with Rabbi Mike is always a blessing. Be blessed in the name of, I guess this is some kind of radio station, YHVH, the name above all names. Mm. Just joking. That's, of course, trying to be the name of God. It's not your local Y chapter. Also, Richard from San Diego says, I am a listener. And he gets a hello from me and from Rabbi Mike. Shalom to you and blessings to you, Richard from San Diego. All I ask is write me an email that has the subject line, I am a listener. I am a listener. That's all I'm asking. I am a listener. Is that so much? It's like doing a like. It's just like pressing the like button. All right. So press the like button. But of course, when it comes to Judaism and Israel, it's so much more than just a like button. I want you to delve in our beloved Torah, delve in the modern story of Israel. And of course, Rabbi Mike and myself are always here for you. Rabbi Mike, thank you so much for joining me.
It's always a pleasure. Shabbat shalom.
Your website, sulamyakov.com. Sulamyakov.com. Check out hebron.com. And, of course, thelandofisrael.com. Oh, and if you want to help, of course, there's a donate button at thelandofisrael.com and also at yishaifleischer.com. Stay tuned. There's more great stuff on this show today. We got a few more amazing audios from you from this week. So God bless you. Stay tuned, stay connected, and stay strong. And shalom.
Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. You know, we are in the process of building our brand new world headquarters located in Gush Etzion, and we want you to partner in this very important project, bringing the Jews home to the land of Israel, building the land, establishing the land, planting in the land. So go to the website, thelandofisrael.com, and click on donate to get involved in this important project, building our new headquarters. Get involved today in this Cause Match campaign. Be a part of the future of the Jewish people here in the land of Israel.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my talk with Rabbi Mike Foyer and Spiritual Cafe. I know that I did. Next up is what I mentioned before, that last night I was at the Kol El Chabad event giving scholarships to students, victims of terror, and people who are orphaned for other reasons as well. I got a chance to speak with Hadas Mizrahi, who's the wife of Baruch Mizrahi. May God avenge his blood. He was murdered 2 years ago in a horrible terrorist shooting. And you're going to hear a little bit of a news clip about that story. And then my talk with Hadas, I promise you, it's going to inspire you. So here we go.
Hundreds of Israelis have attended the funeral of an off-duty police officer who was shot and killed in the West Bank. Baruch Mizrahi was fired at whilst driving near the city of Hebron on his way to a Seder dinner, the traditional feast for the Passover holiday. His wife and child, who were also in the car, were wounded. At the funeral, his wife said she had lost the love of her life in the whistle of a bullet and praised her late husband for his integrity and perseverance. The killing may have been carried out by a Palestinian acting independently of armed factions, according to Israel's internal security minister. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack, which came a day after three Jewish families moved back into a building in Hebron, which has been at the center of a lengthy ownership dispute between Jewish settlers and Palestinians.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to Kol El Chabad. We're at the Barad Scholarship Fund event. We're giving out scholarships to amazing students who have spent their whole year studying hard, doing their tests, sending them to Chabad, and then getting money to continue their studies and get even stronger. And of course, it's a happy event, it's an amazing event, but it's based on something kind of tragic, which is a lot of people who have lost their parents. These are orphans. And one of the saddest stories that is here tonight, turning into a happy story through the children that are growing up, is the story of Baruch Mizrahi, who I remember being his murder in 2014, Erev Pesach, right before Pesach. We were about to go into this incredible, joyous day, and yet we heard that in the Hebron region, a car was overtaken, shot at, and the husband of the family, who was also a very high-ranking police officer, was murdered. His wife was injured. One of the children, 4 out of 5 of his children were in the car, was injured. But this incredible man who had done so much service to the country had been murdered right before Pesach. We're here with Hadas Mizrahi. Hadas, thank you so much for being with us today. And sorry so much for your loss. Tell us a little bit about, it hasn't been that many years. It's been 2 years since that awful Erev Pesach. Tell us a little bit about what you went through, where you are today.
Good evening. 2 years ago, I can remember it's nearly now. We went away Erev Pesach. My husband was in work in the police. He came to us before Pesach. We rushed to Hebron, to our parents. They live in Kiryat Arba. I've got 5 children. 4 of them were in the Corps. We passed Tarkumia. We passed Lachish Tarkumia. Terrorist stand on the way, shooted on us. My husband was straight killed. I was very serious injured. I told my children, open go under the chairs, because now the terrorists are shooting on us. I took the wheel car and I rushed away from the terrorists. We, Baruch Hashem, we had a very big miracle. 45 bullets were in the car. That's our Nes Hagadol. It's very hard because 22 years me and Baruch were together. It's a very, very loss for us, to our family, and for Medinat Israel, Am Israel. He all the time said me and Eretz Israel. But what I want to say, that Chabad, Kolel Chabad, came to me the same day after. They rang to me to hospital. They got my telephone and said to me, look, we're Kolel Chabad. We want to help you. What can we give? What can we do? I said, excuse me, what? I don't feel good. I don't know what you want. So they said, okay, we're coming to hospital to see you, to see what you need. What can we help you? You've got 5 children. I know they need help. Now we are together with you. They came to us. They gave them games. They hugged them. They all Pesach. They were with us together. After Pesach, she told me, your children are in school. They've got chugim. We want to pay for them. We know the children are very good pupils. But I know we know that it will be very hard with the hard in school now to work. We want to give you private teachers to teach them everything. All the time saying, what can we give you? What can we give you? I said, I don't want. It's okay. It's okay. She said, no, we know. We give us to be happy to help you to give us. And really, that's koch, strength of Am Yisrael to know to give to people after what happened to them. And really, I want to say very, very thank you very much for Kolel Chabad, to the Rav Bloy, Orly. They hug us, they give us. It's all quiet, secret. They don't speak about it. And we feel comfortable to come and to take from them. Really, thank you very, very much.
Hadas, your husband was a strong man. He was a defender. He was the head of the cyber unit of the Israeli police for a long time. He was in the army for 25 years. We're talking about a man who the defense of the Jewish people was foremost in his mind. That's what he lived every single day. Other than, of course, being a family man and a lover of the land, he was also a defender, a warrior. You're sitting next to him. Suddenly, he's shot to death by those very terrorists that he's been fighting all his life. Tell me about that feeling.
It was very, very hard because Bach was a strong man. I was a quiet woman sitting under. It was very, very hard. But I know the same minute that I'm fighting with the terrorists because I want to live. I want to grow up my children. I don't know. And I even didn't know what happened behind me because it was very, very quiet. I remember when I took the wheels and I ran away from the terrorists. So I stopped the car. I rang the police. And I look. I put my head to see who's from the children are dead and who are alive. And I say, and then I saw everyone is okay and they're all alive. So I breathed and I said, okay. And I know that I'm very, very injured. I was bleeding from every place. I took my sweater. I covered my hose. I know I want to live. I want to be happy. I want to be strong. That's my fight from the terrorists, to know that the Jews or Am Yisrael chai v'kayam, and you will all live and you won't kill us and you won't happy. These are terrorists were released from, the government released them when we released Gilad Shalit. And it's second time that they're killing and shooting Jews. And they say we will be in jail. They will release us and we will again come and kill Jews. And one of the things is that in fighting with them, that they should know they won't kill again.
When your husband was murdered, the police force also honored him. The country honored him for his service. This was not just a loss to a family and a community, but also to the police force in general. But your children, of course, are the ones that suffer from it the most. How have they grown up in the last 2 years?
Baruch Hashem, you can see my children, they're happy, they're strong, they play, they laugh. You can't see on us that we had a very big tragedy. Because I'm always saying, I will be strong for myself to have a koach for my children to be strong. And Baruch Hashem, Am Israel is with us, Kol El Chabad, and really, they hug us, they give us. I want to say very, very, thank you very, very much.
And the Barad family is sponsoring scholarships tonight. Your children are receiving scholarships tonight?
Yeah, my older one is, she volunteers in Magen David. She learned again in Magen David, and now she's volunteering over there. Tuesday, she even volunteers in a special school with children. They haven't got parents. She's all the time volunteering. And she it comes from her heart, and it gives us strength, her, to know, look, I got a lot from Am Israel. Now I want to give my side to Am Israel. And for me, it gives Baruch Hashem a lot of koach. It does me happy. It does our family good that we know that they volunteer. Me and Baruch, together, when we met, we volunteered in Mishteret Israel and in Magen David. I even volunteered. I volunteered in a few places. One of the things that I do now is every time that I hear that somebody lost her husband or her husband lost his wife in a terrorist or in every place, I go to the family, I speak to them, and I say, look on me. I think I was the same like you. I'm coming to give my strength like I got from Am Israel. I'm giving it to you. This is my telephone. I would like to see you in a few months, few years, happy, going up and seeing yourself on the right way like your woman wanted to be, or your wife that you lost, to see only good. And the children, if you will be happy, the children will be happy. Im en ani mili.
Hadas Mizrahi, thank you so much for your courage, your triumph. Sorry for your loss, but thank you for your strength, and that'll inspire so many other people who have lost, need that strength, and together with families like yourselves, communities like yourselves, people like your husband and yourself who have volunteered all your life, now your daughter who's a volunteer, will continue to be strong, and together with Kol El Chabad, the Barad family, and the scholarship that your child is receiving tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. B'tzmachot.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my interview at the Kol El Chabad event, giving scholarships to students, with Hadas Mizrahi, a victim of terror, whose husband was murdered right before her eyes, and yet she continues to be incredibly strong. Now let's go to Israel Advocacy, and we're going to speak with Joe Sabag. I met Joe Sabag in a beautiful Jerusalem night. Here's my talk with super Israeli advocate, pro-Israel advocate, Joe Sabag. Usually, you're going to hear some of my recordings from Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov and throughout Jerusalem. Oftentimes, it's hot summer days around here, and yet I love, 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 love Jerusalem nights. I love Jerusalem nights. There is nothing better than Jerusalem nights. I love the atmosphere, the Mediterranean atmosphere. People are out in cafes and shops walking around. It's cool. It's beautiful, and it's so vibrant. I just met some young people from Montreal. We were just talking. They had seen me on TV or something, and they were like, we were talking, and they're like French speakers, so they understand the Mediterranean atmosphere. We were talking about just how vibrant it all is. I told them it's like biting from a super juicy fruit. It's like it's so much life is here in Israel, and I love nighttime. Nighttime is the right time. And we're here in Mamilla Mall, one of the places that has become a tremendous artery of restaurants and shops and fun. And amazingly, it was 10 years ago that this was basically no man's land. It was a place that you just didn't go to. It was a dark place. You know, the dark seediness was well known, and it was just outside of Jaffa Gate. Now it's become the avenue right into the old city. Interestingly enough, just as this is the avenue to the old city, I always tell people, you know, the Western Wall that we all love so much as a place of prayer, actually, and 2,000 years ago, was the Mamilla of yesteryear. It was exactly where the shops were, people hanging out before they went to the temple. So this is really, I think, the corridor that leads into the old city and into the Temple of Jerusalem. And to get to the Temple of Jerusalem, it's not going to be just Jews that are going to be doing it. We know, of course, from the Bible and from the book of Zechariah, that it's going to be Jews and Gentiles throughout the world that are going to come and pay homage to the God of Israel, who's really going to be the God of all peoples, the conduit through which is going to be Israel and the land of Israel. But it's really a global phenomenon. Of course it is. God made the world. And I'm here at a new restaurant. I haven't been up at this restaurant in a long time. It's called Happy Fish, which reminds me, of course, of the blessing of of Jacob to his sons, that Vid Gularov, you should multiply greatly like fish. We're under the stars, and I'm here with one of my favorite people and one of the most intelligent people fighting for Israel today, Joe Sabag. He's an attorney, but today works as the U.S. director for the Israel Allies Foundation, which is an organization that really unites parliamentarians throughout the world that are pro-Israel in their faith or otherwise, brings them to Israel, connects them, and really creates laws. And that's what Joe is also part of. He's also part of legislation that is actually making a tremendous difference for Israel. He's our secret weapon in the United States right now. But he is here today. He gave a speech at the Knesset. 17 Knesset members and ministers were there. And then he spent the whole day presenting some of the bills that he's working on in the United States to really change policy in Israel's favor. Joe, thank you so much for joining me at Happy Fish.
Shalom, Am Yisrael. It's great to be back in Israel, Yishai. I love coming on the show, and I don't think I've done radio since the last time I was on your show.
It is a really beautiful night tonight, isn't it?
Ashreinu.
It's really a perfect weather, there's nothing more beautiful than Jerusalem. But Jerusalem, you know, and it's, we can get tricked by this situation right now. We're sitting here at the restaurant. One could think everything is just honky-dory. But the truth is, Joe, you and I both know tremendous pressures come down upon Israel. Tremendous pressures come down upon this country to give away land, to be in one way or another boycotted, divested, and sanctioned. Israel's in the news all the time. There's UNESCOs that are trying to erase our narrative. I call UNESCO the legitimate arm of the jihad. Our prime minister is going to get a phone call every day from somebody, including the president of the United States of America, and he's going to get pressure to do something or other, usually towards weakening the Jewish people and certainly erasing our narrative. Right now, we're here at Mamila. You might think everything is just, you know, great. Everything is latte and delicious fish, but it's not like that, is it?
Hey, take nothing for granted.
Joe, you've been working on policies to stymie and limit the BDS movement in the United States. That's what you were presenting about. What exactly is the threat of BDS in the United States? I thought the United States is a friendly, loving country to Israel. What is the threat of BDS? How do we fight it?
You know, the good news is that I came here to deliver good news. Thankfully, we've seen legislation passed now in 13 states around America that confronts really the commercial aspects of BDS. And as much as BDS is manifesting as commercial activity, those activities have now been confronted in 13 different states. It's fabulous. It's reasonable to expect that we'll see similar legislation pass in probably 15 to 20 more states over the course of the coming year. So really something to celebrate.
What is BDS exactly? How does it work really, like, in the context of the United States? Give me a concrete example.
There's really two ways to think of it. First of all, you know, as commercial activity, we're talking about basically boycotts, you know, commercial discrimination against entities and products of Israeli origin. That's the smaller end of the problem. Okay, the bigger end of the problem is the cultural battle that we're facing. That's where we start talking about delegitimization of Israel's right to exist, delegitimization of Israel's right to self-defense, and overall, it's the bigger problem that we're confronting. The good news is that these new laws that are passing are a great starting point as far as getting public policy on our side to begin with, but they fall way short of being able to deal with the cultural aspects of BDS. What I spoke about today in the Knesset really is what I've come to see as the beating heart of BDS itself, and that's the lie of occupation. Okay, occupation, as I've said before and we've discussed many times on this show, is really just a polite way of calling Israel a thief. It's the suggestion that colonialist Jews made their way into Arab territory, that we tossed them out, and that we've taken the ones who are here and subjugated them, not giving them national rights, and that somehow these poor victimized Arabs need to be restored what's rightfully theirs. That needs to change. If we're going to defeat BDS, we need to defeat the lie of occupation. What we know is that occupation in the legal sense, it's a complete falsehood, that the Jewish people have material rights under international law, starting with Balfour, certainly stemming from San Remo, and then onwards, Article 80, and so on and so forth. I would suggest that those who are interested in that take a look at a fabulous law review article written by the great Howard Grief that was published in the Nativ Journal. called The Borders and Legal Rights of Israel Under International Law, published in 2008. That's really a very good, succinct 10-page primer on the basic legal facts that people need to know if they're going to explain how it is that Israel is, in fact, not an occupier. One of the bigger challenges we face is the fact that the use of this term occupation and other terms that stem from this occupation narrative have been very casually taken on even by our own institutions. How often does somebody open up the Jerusalem Post or some other Israel coverage, you know, paper and see the expression West Bank or settlers or settlements or East Jerusalem being used as a proper noun?
Those are some of the easy ones. We caught the JTA using calling the tomb of the founding fathers and mothers, the Machpelah. They called it the Ibrahimi Mosque. Okay, which is a much more egregious, that's not even within, it's like a complete slippage away of any accepted term in Israel or the Jewish world. I want to tell you that yesterday I gave a talk to students who are here on a kind of fact-finding mission, Jewish students, and I've done this many times, and I've met these kind of folks many times, but I'm amazed over and over again. They have, A, no sense of our rights. They have only a sense of other people's rights, the Arab rights, the Palestinian rights. They sense nothing about defending our rights. They feel completely guilty about Israel altogether. They think that Zionism means to create a Palestinian state. That's their new definition of what Zionism is. And they just, they have no, I was amazed at the lack of defense for our peoplehood. They just have no concern of defense for our peoplehood.
Agreed. But, you know, today
again,
was
in that sense that we had here at the restaurant, which is everything is hunky-dory, they think that Israel is fine, and it's actually the oppressor.
What's within our reach to change are the choices that we make. The fact that language has been weaponized against us and that we've casually taken on the use of that type of language and expression, it doesn't help our cause. That's really, you know, to me, the starting point of starting, you know, to confront this cultural battle that's happening. We have to control what's within our reach to begin with. The Knesset itself also needs to make choices. It's not reasonable for the Knesset to expect that their allies around the world are going to get to work in confronting the lie of occupation and confronting BDS if they themselves are not putting forth the ultimate effort in this battle.
You told Knesset members that they've got to change their tune about two-state.
I was more specific. Okay, I think that for starters, I think the Knesset needs to go ahead and explicitly reject the Sasson report. Regarding the two-state solution, you know, it's something that we've discussed in the past. There really are only two supporting rationales for people who like to promote the two-state solution. One is what I call the disengagement perspective, which is generally the idea that, hey, two incompatible people have unfortunately ended up sharing the same space, and it's desirable to separate them. Okay, that's been the rationale of Bill Clinton. It was the rationale of George Bush. It was the rationale of various Israeli prime ministers who decided to move ahead with the idea of land for peace. The other rationale is the occupation perspective. And this is the perspective that says, hey, Israel is a thief. Those poor Arabs are victims, and we need a two-state solution because this is a matter of justice. That's the perspective of President Obama. Unfortunately, that's the perspective of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It's the perspective of J Street. How do we know this? Because we hear them using the term occupation and then referring to parts of Israel as being territorially illegitimate.
Illegitimate. That's
illegitimate.
That's the big word that they've used. All right. You know what? You've now shifted towards naming not only the current president of the United States, but also one of the candidates, the presumptive leader of the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, who is running for president. And I'm looking at what's going on in the United States from afar, from Israel. I know a lot of times that looking from afar skews things. I wanted to ask you, what is really the mood in the United States right now? Trump. Is Clinton, we know who she is, we know who she's been, we've seen her as Secretary of State. Here comes this new player. He, on the one hand, is a populist and a people's person in a lot of ways, and you get a sense that he's kind of helping the working man get back up into a sense of, you know, that his right and America's great again and all that kind of stuff. At the same time, he uses oftentimes unpleasant language, foul language. On the other hand, you also see him being relatively pro-Israel. He's pro-Jewish, certainly. He's a New Yorker. That makes him half a Jew already. And he, you know, his daughter married Jewish. And, you know, she became a Jew herself, and a fascinating Jew at that. He's chosen this running mate, Mike Pence, who we know is, and I remember my good friend Josh Haston was on this network, interviewed Mike Pence, and it's a very close friend to Israel that we know. Tell me about the mood in the United States. Where is it really going?
Anger. You know, I'm less interested in Trump himself or Clinton herself. What's much more fascinating to me is the dynamic in particular that's been at work on both sides of the aisle. I think Trump ended up in this position as the nominee, not so much because of who he is, but this raw, angry populist sentiment. People are really upset right now. And we know that this is the case because if we look across the line at the other side, we see that Bernie Sanders, in essence, was also a candidate who was channeling popular anger. The basic message was, hey, do you feel that America is getting the short end of the stick? Do you feel that this is coming personally at your expense in one way or another? And a lot of people stood up and said, yes, yes, I do. And I think that that's an across-the-board dynamic. And so it's going to make this electoral cycle absolutely one of the most sociologically fascinating election cycles that we have ever seen. I mean, it's really an interesting situation where anything can happen. I don't really think that the polls are very reliable. I think that there are too many variables right now and that really anything can happen. So, you know, people should just really, really prepare themselves for what's going to be some very, very interesting weeks to come.
Here's an interesting axis, Joe. Putin, Brexit, and Trump. Kind of return to nationalism, a kind of return to national power, a kind of rejection of liberalism, a kind of rejection of the post-conflict vision of the EU. It's a Theresa May, the new Prime Minister of England, is already talking about nuclearization, the next nuclear subs that they're going to be building. Trump is certainly all about the rule of law and the defense of borders. And Putin is certainly a pushback against jihadism, a certain kind of nationalism, a rights of our people, a Russian kind of hegemon, let's put it that way. Do you see an axis like that growing of people returning to nationalism in this world that seems to have been saturated by an EU way of thinking, an Obama way of thinking?
To an extent. But again, I think that that nationalism can be further refined down into an expression of anger, really. In this case, you know, Trump is framing the issue in terms of, hey, you know, don't you care about your country? Don't you feel that the country is getting the short end of the stick? But really, you know, as we take a harder look at that, we understand that it's a personal message that's being delivered. Don't you feel that the problems your country is facing is actually facing you at home, at your job, in your household, in your livelihood, in your bank account? So I just think ultimately, you know, nationalism is one way of characterizing it, but in its much more raw form, I really do think that it's just ultimately it's anger, but it's a selfish anger in a way.
Interesting. Turkey is going the other way, it seems like. Some kind of coup, maybe even engineered by Erdogan himself, maybe not, but in any case being used very quickly to solidify power and to create an Erdogan type of Iranian state where he's the mullah, and another kind of Middle East player dropping towards Islamicism.
Yeah, this is generally the trend. We understand that Turkey, in looking around the broader Middle East, obviously has its own traditions of leadership within the Islamic world. And, you know, certainly those irredentist points of view that exist in a lot of Islamic countries, you know, they're concerned about their position within the Islamic world. So surprising, not so much.
How important is Israel in the United States right now?
Israel is very important in the United States.
Why? If I was an American, I wouldn't give a hoot about this little Middle East country far away.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the idea of, you know, bipartisanship and the idea that both the Republicans and Democrats share, you know, identical views on Israel right now, this is, you know, total synthetic nonsense. It's just not the case. You know, let's take a look first at the Democrats. You know, there's been a lot of hubbub. They've had three different sessions now regarding their platform and its expressions in terms of support or whether to decrease that support for Israel. Obviously, we know that Bernie Sanders was able to select, you know, that Hillary Clinton allowed Bernie Sanders to select several members of the platform committee, several of them who are just openly hostile to Israel, you know, Cornel West, Zogby, some of those characters. And they're ultimately, you know, their goal was to try and specifically have the Democratic Party identify Israel as an occupier and likewise identify parts of Israel as being colonialist settlements and not actual communities that have been established and where people live normal lives.
And illegitimate.
And illegitimate, yeah. So, you know, that's been
Is that reflective of a true division in the United States? Or is that like, you know, intellectual elites controlling and sending down a message?
It's not elites. I think it's indicative of a split within the soul of the Democratic Party itself. Strange bedfellows, there's no question. On one hand, you've got the vast, overwhelming majority of American Jews who, you know, socially identify, you know, with liberal principles, and therefore they're very much a part of the Democratic Party. But at the same time, we have to be realistic about who's living under that big tent with them. That's something that we saw on full display 4 years ago in Charlotte at the Democratic Convention when it came time to amend the Democratic platform regarding Israel, and there were boos and shouts and everything else. It's definitely what's being expressed by Bernie Sanders and his friends.
A Jew.
Yeah, a Jew. But then again, don't Jews always make the best anti-Semites? You know, so what can I say? It's sad. We would hope that the first Jew to rise to such a prominent position on a political ticket would have been something we could be much more proud of, but it is what it is. Nevertheless, you know, the point is that the struggle among the Democrats really has been over the question of whether or not to decrease support for Israel and to, you know, really turn the conversation to one of confronting Israel and occupation. The other side of the line has been very interesting as well. We saw that there were very significant fundamental changes made to the Republican platform, which, you know, they were made for the sake of improving the party's support of Israel. We see that the party at this point now came out with very strong language supporting the indivisibility of Jerusalem, something that had been lacking in the platform from 2012. We saw also that the party stayed silent and didn't make any mention of a two-state solution or land for peace.
And talked about returning the embassy to Jerusalem, seemingly this time in a serious manner.
Yes, and most importantly, the Republican Party explicitly rejected the notion that Israel's an occupier. We can't begin to underestimate the value of that statement, Yishai. It's incredible.
You know, it's interesting. One of the bright politicians here in Israel, Bezalel Smotrich, was on an Israeli comedy, political comedy show. And they said to him, but the world is against your perspective. He's, of course, from the Beit Yehudi, the Jewish Home Party, a nationalist, a right-wing politician. And he said immediately, he's like, you don't really know what's going on. In America, the Republican Party is already shifting its platform. Did you know that? It's shifting its platform away from two-state. And they just like were like, oh, it's Trump. And they kind of like, you know, poo-pooed it. But like I noticed that he had noticed and that he said on public television, hey, the world, part of the world that you're always telling us the world is going to tell us to do this and that, is shifting away from that consciousness that we're an occupier. I was blown away by how quick he assimilated that new political reality.
Well, I would say, you know, very good. That news obviously needs to be delivered all around the Knesset and all around Israel. I think we should definitely be appreciative of that expression of support. You know, and certainly it's impossible for the Jew to be an occupier in the land of Israel and, you know, an area that's been known as Judea since time immemorial. But, you know, this really brings us back to the fact that in many ways we've submitted and provided too much acquiescence to the occupation narrative. You know, I was thinking earlier and when I spoke today, I used a quote that was an anecdote that Jabotinsky cites. You know, he went about 100 years ago earlier on in World War I to visit with Max Nordau because he wanted to discuss his vision for establishing the Judean Regiment. So he lays
the first kind of Jewish army in 2,000 years. It was under it was part of the British army at the end.
It was.
Really was the, in a lot of ways, it was also the first seeds of the IDF.
Correct.
Many officers and many folks, the soldiers that came out of that regiment that was built with the British, you know, under the British rubric, in the end were the founders of the IDF.
Correct. So Jabotinsky and Nordau, eventually the conversation turns to, well, what's going to be done about those folks who are going to object to this idea because they're so concerned about how it will affect the sympathies of the rest of the world and what world opinion would have to say if the Jews actually established their own army, or at least their division within the British army. Nordau turns to Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky first, he says to him, look, how can we allow the fools among our people to dictate our policy? Which was an expression in and of itself that was really remarkable. And Nordau turns to him and he says, look, everything that you're laying out here is perfectly logical, but logic is a Greek art and the Jew can't stand it. Just because the Jew walks outside and sees rain clouds doesn't mean that he goes and buys an umbrella. Oh, no. The way that the Jew learns is by going outside, getting soaking wet, and catching pneumonia, and only then does he make up his mind. That's what's happened, you know, really unfortunately with the lie of occupation. It's raining down on us, and we've really reached a pivotal moment here where I think that the Israeli government, more than any other group of Jews anywhere, more so than, you know, American Jewish leadership, more so than the Republican Party, it's the Knesset and the Israeli government that's deciding whether or not we're going to catch pneumonia. Because I think we've reached that critical turning point where we're soaking wet from it. We're sick. And that's the bottom line, is that the occupation narrative has corrupted things to such an extent that even the noble endeavor of peacemaking, you know, for all these folks who wanted to, you know, pursue peace with the Arabs, whatever the basis was, the point is that now in the United States, when somebody's talking about the two-state solution, everybody but the pro-Israel community views that as an implicit indictment of the Israeli occupation. I mean, the lie of occupation has even corrupted our ability to engage in peacemaking. Because at the end of the day, if we don't reach an agreement, their talking point is, well, then we have to return to the conversation about the fact that the occupation can't continue and that this in and of itself is not sustainable and so on and so forth. So I realize that this is all kind of, you know, roundabout, but there are just 100 different ways of, you know, tracing so many of our problems back to this lie of occupation. I really do think that it's really got to be treated as a top priority.
Well, the lie of occupation, Joe, and we're speaking with Joe Sabag, who's the U.S. director of the Israel Allies Foundation. You know, Joe, the deep truth about the lie of occupation is that it really comes from another disease, and that is the ambivalence of the state of Israel vis-a-vis these lands. Yeah. And that ambivalence comes on the face of it because there's a lot of Arabs there, and they're afraid to bring them into the Israeli civil body politic. Okay, that makes sense. They're also afraid of it as because it's actually what it is, which is the historic homeland, which ties us into Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and that whole biblical tradition and the King David. And it scares. It scares Israelis. It scares Israelis to be that. We are Tel Aviv, latte drinking Mediterranean Western folks, and we ain't no Middle East camel jockeys with some kind of talking to some wall and God. And that's what scares, you know, some people. And that's what there's a backdrop to this Judean Samaria, to the occupation. In some place, Israelis for a long time have wanted to give it away. They've wanted to give it away because they haven't wanted that part of their identity. In large measure, this debate is also about what kind of Jew do you want to be? How do you want to look? And that has eroded us to such an extent that we've also lost credibility in the eyes of the world. We haven't wanted to be the Jew, the full Jew. And I, of course, don't mean to denigrate our Tel Aviv identity, but it also has to incorporate that Hebron identity, and that's been very hard. But now, as you're saying, this pneumonia has kicked in so hard that it's like we can't deny it anymore. We need to hold on to this land, and we need to proclaim it clearly.
Yishai, you know, we're Jewish, and we should be proud about that fact. That's all I can say. You know, it's a shame that there are some Jews who don't appreciate this beautiful heritage that Hashem gave to us. But, you know, the more that do, I think in general, it leads us in a healthy direction. So, you know, as I contemplate these issues and being a proud Jewish person myself and obviously having committed an entire career to that fact, you know, I think of us as a unique people who've received three unique gifts from Hashem that really define us. Shabbat, we received the Torah, and we received the land of Israel. If you go into even the most reformed of all synagogues or, you know, whatever lies beyond that on the spectrum, and you open up the Ark, and you take a look at their Torah, you're going to find that not even a single Aleph is missing from the Torah. Or even if you went and spoke to, you know, the most secularized person and said, you know, tell me about Shabbat, how many hours are in Shabbat? They would still tell you, well, you know, 25 hours, you know, give or take. Because again, the integrity of the entire 24-hour day has been preserved, and nobody has come to the point where they're suggesting that Shabbat is anything less than a complete, you know, one-day-plus cycle. Yet the land of Israel, you have people who want to suggest that the land itself should be divided. It's really tragic when you think of it that way. And for me, I personally view it in that context. We wouldn't accept the idea of, you know, cutting pieces out of the Torah. We wouldn't accept the idea that Shabbat should be cut in half for convenience sake or whatever else. But too many of us are willing to accept the idea that the land of Israel should be cut up into pieces.
Joe Sabag, you are the U.S. Director of the Israel Allies Foundation. At this time, it's hard to even contemplate that Jews would be willing to give away land or that we would have enemies, because it's such a beautiful night in Jerusalem. Oh. It's so wonderful to have you in town. It's a breath of fresh air. You are fighting for Israel's cause behind the scenes with legislation that is making a tremendous difference. That's why you got to speak today at the Knesset to present that, and that's why Knesset members lent their ears to what you're doing, which is a lot of times more than what they're doing. That's a different topic. In any case, we are very proud and happy to have a state of Israel. We are so lucky to have a Jerusalem. We're so lucky to have a Shabbat and a Torah and an indivisible Jewish capital, the city of Yerushalayim. But the fringes are, the edges are being frayed. They're still being fought for very much. And people like yourself are out there at the edges, seeing where it's being frayed and trying to mend them. Same thing with Hebron, where I get to work every single day and hold on to that piece of land and really the foundations of the Jewish people. I want to thank you so much for being with me here at Happy Fish.
Thanks so much. You know, just to close and say goodbye to everybody, I really believe that if we just hold on and make sure that not just Torah, not just Shabbat remain indivisible, but also that Yerushalayim remains indivisible and the land of Israel remains indivisible, Jewish continuity is something that absolutely will prevail. So with that, I want to wish everybody here shalom uvracha. I look forward to being back here in Israel again in a few weeks, hopefully celebrating more victories against BDS, more victories against people who would do harm to Israel. Yishai, thanks for having me on again.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my talk with Joe Sabag. He's one of the greatest pro-Israel activists I know out there. He's making policies and a lot of stuff that's even behind the scenes that he didn't talk about. The bottom line is that he is a person who's living in America and yet doing everything he can for the Jewish state and for the rebirth of the Jewish state. We are living in amazing times, ladies and gentlemen. And right now I'm recording this audio in Hebron, in the Jewish community of Hebron, right across from the Avraham Avinu Synagogue, which was destroyed during the Jordanian period, but recently rebuilt and re-beautified. And it's just like it stood for the last 500 years. And as this Avraham Avinu Synagogue has been rebuilt, so will the Third Temple. I want to thank all of you for being with me. I want to thank Ben Bresky and my buddy Moshe from Idaho, who does such a great job of throwing up the show and getting it to the world. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to my team and all of you out there. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Check out thelandofisrael.com, which is one of the great networks of radio and video coming out of Israel. Check out Hebron.com for our amazing website that will give you a portal to our parents, to our moms and dads. Check out my Facebook page and my website and my Twitter. It's all at Yishai Fleischer. It's a way to connect with me, whatever and whichever kind of a portal you like. Even LinkedIn, I'm there as well. So just at Yishai Fleischer. Most important is at Hashem. You know, if you want to connect with God, he's actually, his at sign is everywhere. And just open up his Torah, come to his land, be part of his great story. Capital H, capital U. You are doing a great thing by listening to the show, being part of our story, being part of the network. So be strong, be connected, never take no for an answer. Be part of the story. God bless you, and shalom.
Get Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel, where prophecy meets reality. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com, for more information.